From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. President Trump caps off a week of tumultuous trade talks and tariff policy with a triumphant address to a raucous crowd in Illinois.
The days of plundering American jobs and wealth, those days are over.
The Michael Cohen tape, a recording of his conversation with then-candidate Donald Trump.
What finance?
We'll have to pay you some.
Deadline passes to reunite thousands of children separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. Here's CBS News correspondent Maria Villarreal.
There are still more than 700 separated. 463 of them have parents who may have already been deported.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Weijia Jiang, Catherine Rampell, and Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. Did you hear a walk back from President Trump on trade this week? If the economy is buzzing along, does anything else matter to you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Great panel today. Joining me from Washington, Weijia Jiang, White House correspondent for CBS News. Weijia, great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
With us from New York also, Catherine Rampell, columnist at The Washington Post, who covers economics, public policy, politics, and culture. You can find a link to her latest column headlined, "The Economy's Great." That doesn't mean Trumponomics is. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Catherine, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here, Jane.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Weijia, and Catherine.
So strong news and big headlines for President Trump today. Here he is, President Trump, speaking on the South Lawn of the White House this morning, touting new numbers that show the U.S. economy continues to surge, growing at a rate of 4.1% in the last quarter.
We're on track to hit the highest annual average growth rate in over 13 years. And I will say this right now, and I'll say it strongly, as the trade deals come in one by one, we're going to go a lot higher than these numbers, and these are great numbers.
Catherine Rampell, the U.S. economy growing at its fastest rate since 2014. What do you see in these important numbers?
I think the main thing to keep in mind is that GDP numbers are very noisy. They bounce around from quarter to quarter, so you don't want to read too much into any one quarter. This number is good. We want stronger growth, but it's partly a reaction to more tepid growth last quarter. It's partly a result of the fact that companies were freaking out about the coming tariffs and decided to stockpile a lot of goods. Soybean exports are an excellent example of this. Soybean exports rose something like 3,000%, according to one forecast from Pantheon Economics.
Mm-hmm. So snapping up these products before these big tariffs kick in.
Right, exactly. So you see a lot of companies trying to front run the coming bad policies, in this case, for soybean tariffs. And so you'll see a reversal of that likely later this year. So the question is, even if we have good growth this quarter, how sustainable is it given these weird trade factors, given that we have a little bit of a sugar high from the Trump tax cuts as well as a big spending hike? And so if all of that fades, how sustainable will this be? Because we did have several quarters of strong growth under Obama, which Republicans like to forget, you know, but we had relatively tepid growth as an overall trend, even though, again, the numbers bounced around quarter to quarter. We had a few good quarters. We may be seeing the same thing this time around.
Weijia Jiang, the president says the economy is heading in the right direction. He says these are big numbers. This is big news for this president and his economy. What do you see?
Well, it is. But to Catherine's point, you know, I think he also recognized that those questions would arise. And so during his remarks at the White House, he made a point to say, you know, I've talked to my economic advisors, and not only are these numbers great right now, but they are very sustainable. And he predicted an outstanding forecast to come as well. Of course, he didn't commit to any numbers, but his message is very clear. And look, I think your question that you asked to your callers is really important. Does anything else matter to you? Because I can tell you that, you know, going to recent Trump campaign rallies, he continues to celebrate the economy and everything that he has done, and it's working. You know, people that we speak with who are in lines now, of course, these are Trump supporters, but they seem to have fatigue about all the other things that are happening in Washington, and they don't want to talk about, you know, foreign policy. You know, they obviously have interest in other domestic issues, but this is sort of a siren, and this is very important for them. And you know, in talking to them, they say the bottom line is, I have more money in my pocket. And so how can you say the president is not doing something right if that's the case? Now, whether that is instant gratification and whether we will actually see, you know, a turn to come shortly even, you know, for now, I think what matters to his base and his supporters is that they are feeling the benefits.
Well, one point to add to that is that actually wages have been flat when you adjust for inflation. Year over year in June, they were exactly flat in real terms. So some of his supporters may be feeling flush, but if you look at the actual numbers, you know, whatever growth we're seeing is not actually flowing through to workers.
Mm. A lot plays into these calculations, of course. These numbers come on the heels of an important meeting this week, an important trade meeting with European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. Here's President Trump lauding the results of those trade talks in a roundtable discussion in Iowa. That's yesterday.
Basically, we opened up Europe, and that's going to be a great thing for Europe, and it's been really going to be a great thing for us, and it's going to be a really great thing for our farmers, because you have just gotten yourself one big market.
And here is EU President Jean-Claude Juncker saying he and President Trump have pulled back from an all-out trade war.
When I was invited by the president to the White House, I had one intention. I had the intention to make a deal today. And we made a deal today. We have identified a number of areas on which to work together. Work towards zero tariffs on industrial goods. That was my main intention. To propose to come down to zero tariffs on industrial goods.
So, Catherine Rampell, President Trump surprised supporters and some critics this week with this meeting and agreeing to work to lower some of these tariffs. What did you make of the meeting? Was this an about face to your mind, a genuine truce? How do you see it?
I see it as a pause in a very worrying escalation. There was no actual deal that was made, to be clear. Even though the White House keeps calling it a deal, President Juncker sort of referred to it as a deal. But to be clear, what happened was we had these escalating tariffs and tit-for-tat tariffs. We imposed them. The EU retaliated, just as many other countries had retaliated. And effectively, both sides said, okay, we're going to pause that. They took the pin out of the grenade and they put it back in the grenade. But the idea that there is some fantastic new deal that resulted from that is just false. What they're doing is they agreed to continue talking to avoid letting things get worse. And it's great that we might be moving towards zero tariffs. But this also would not be something new. Obama's administration was negotiating something called TTIP, which was a trade deal that was in the works with the EU that Trump put on pause that was also working towards the same goals. So I feel like it's a little bit three steps forward standing in, or three steps backward, I guess, then maybe standing in place and then getting a lot of credit for not falling even further backward.
Weijia Jiang, President Trump talked tough on trade with the EU for so long. He told your network last week that the EU is a foe of the U.S. What did you make of this change in tone? Is this purely political? Are there economics at play here? What do you see?
Well, I think, you know, what we see with President Trump so often is that he loves to use tough talk as a tool. And certainly yesterday, or rather when he did meet with President Juncker, it was a complete shift. And he made it a point to say this is a new phase of a close friendship. He posted a picture online, I don't know if you saw it, but of them, you know, kissing, embracing in the Oval Office to show that actually, you know, even though I used the word foe, we are friends. And so perhaps when I spoke to some European diplomats, their take was that it's actually a compliment. They were trying to spin it, that it puts us in a position to negotiate with President Trump, because when he calls us a foe, what he really means is we are a competitor, and that means he has respect for us. But I think Catherine's absolutely right. I mean, you have to also think about the timing of this announcement with the EU. Remember, it was right after the Department of Agriculture announced a $12 billion package to assist farmers who are really being impacted by Chinese tariffs.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so that's an acknowledgement, whether, you know, however you want to call it, that is an acknowledgement that the tariffs are, in fact, hurting a great part of his constituency in the Midwest, and that in the meantime, while we hash out these deals with China, here's some help. The problem is when you speak to farmers and experts in their industry, you know, it's addressing the wrong problem. You know, farmers are hurting because of the Chinese tariffs. They made it a point to say the EU will now purchase more soybeans. But the question is, even if they did, even if they actually signed an agreement, will that number that the EU buys make up for the deficit that China is creating by cutting back?
Right.
And the answer is no, not even close. And so I think there's a fear that even though the president is touting progress with Europe, mm-hmm. what about China? What about NAFTA? There's so many other trade deals that he has to work on.
Right. And so, Jack Beatty, this is all happening to that point against the backdrop of so many things. The NAFTA talks, the steel, the aluminum trade tariffs with China. We're seeing all these trade measures piling on. The lists of goods that are impacted is getting longer and longer. What's at stake here to your mind if this trade war ramps up even further? What are you seeing looking forward?
Well, the larger context to me is this is all unfolding in a political economy of inequality, all of which longstanding, but made much worse by the Republican tax cut of 2017. By one estimate, in 10 years, 83% of the benefits are going to go to the top 1%, and most other people, middle class people, will be paying more in taxes. This tax cut delivered each Koch brother a $500 million a year cut. Now, That money isn't going to fall down and raise wages anytime soon, it doesn't seem. And so whatever happens, the question is, when do ordinary people begin to benefit?
Jack Beatty, Catherine Rampell, Weijia Zhang, stick with us. We're talking about the week in the news, and you can join us, listeners. What do you hear in the Michael Cohen tape? Would you take away the security clearance from the president's critics? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of the podcast Hidden Brain. This summer, we're sharing a series about reinventing yourself. We call it You 2.0. Add us to your summer listening for ideas about responding to life's messiness and chaos with wisdom.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're taking a look back at the week in the news this hour, and you can join the conversation. What did the Cohen tapes reveal to you about candidate Trump, if anything? Should the White House have removed that CNN reporter this week? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Terrific panel, Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, Weijia Zhang of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Want to get a caller in here from Des Moines, Iowa. Laura is on the line. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the news this morning, as everyone else did, about the economy growing and unemployment is down. And I think the reality on the ground is a little different. I think for working class people, especially here in farm country, in rural areas, and you've got towns in Iowa that have more horses than children. And when you have whole communities that are just kind of disappearing, I think that speaks to a deeper problem. And the way that this president, you know, sort of does his policies is, it's just terrible for farmers. I mean, saying one thing and then 2 weeks later, another thing. Meanwhile, they've already, you know, they're looking at harvesting and buying seeds for next year. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they think a year ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, you've got GOP policies here in the state level that, are requiring, or they're not letting counties raise the minimum wage. I mean, they basically passed legislation to keep elected officials and their constituents from raising the minimum wage.
There's no question that a lot of people are thinking about this, Laura, and a lot of farmers, quite frankly, are worried about that. I appreciate your call there from Des Moines, Laura. Thank you. John from our website says, I'd like to see those new GDP numbers just released compared to concurrent contributions to the national debt.
A lot of reaction to this one. Stay tuned. We'll keep covering it. I want to turn to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein now, because on Wednesday, a group of 11 House Republicans introduced five articles of impeachment against the Deputy Attorney General, accusing him of intentionally withholding information from Congress. Here's Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan, one of the 11, telling Fox News why.
We're tired of the Justice Department giving us the finger and not giving us the information we're entitled to do our constitutional duty. More importantly, the American people are sick of it.
And here's House Speaker Paul Ryan at a press conference yesterday saying he does not support the impeachment of the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, for three reasons.
I don't think we should be cavalier with this process or with this term. Number two, I don't think that this rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, a really high standard. Number three, we, since I got involved, have been getting a lot of compliance from DOJ on the document requests. We do not have full compliance, and we have to get full compliance, but we've been making tremendous progress to that point.
Weijia Jiang, in fact, this morning, Representative Mark Meadows said he is backing off, essentially tabling the effort to impeach Rosenstein. I mean, we all know the president has criticized Rosenstein and his boss, Jeff Sessions, the Justice Department writ large. What's been the White House response to the call this week? And what do you see now that it appears to be they're stepping back from this?
Well, you know, I think when the House Speaker comes out and says, look, I don't support this, it is a huge signal that it's not going to work. And I think that, you know, Representative Meadows acknowledged that he would not have the votes to pass the resolution. And so I think they're trying to shift plans now and perhaps try to hold Rosenstein in contempt of Congress if the DOJ does not give them the documents that they want. But, you know, it's not just Speaker Ryan. Yesterday, we also heard from Rosenstein's boss, from Jeff Sessions, who actually endorsed him and said he had full faith in what Rosenstein was doing and thought he was doing, what he was supposed to. And so when you have these two pieces, and then that's against just 11 in a very small caucus, I think it's clear that even though when you first hear the words impeachment resolution, it sounds like a bombshell, when you actually step back and realize mm-hmm. that Republican leaders, and not just Paul Ryan, but Representative Trey Gowdy also, who has spoken out in support of Rosenstein, you know, it becomes very clear that perhaps this is a political battle and it's not actually about the job that Rosenstein and the DOJ is doing.
Jack Beatty, do you see that as a political battle? What are the optics of this to your mind, and how does it play to the president's base going into the midterms?
Well, I expect that it'll whip up some feeling. But, you know, the context here is a historic development. This week, we learned in a Quinnipiac poll that a slight majority of Americans are convinced that Putin has something on President Trump. Mm. That never has been true of any president. That belief is just inconceivable to someone like me. Raised in the Eisenhower years, it sounds like unbelievable science fiction. And this comes when there's talk that sometime in September, Mueller is going to send a report to Congress documenting an obvious pattern of obstruction of justice. And at a time when the collusion issue is heating up with new revelations from Michael Cohen that he knows of a meeting that President Trump knew in advance mm-hmm. of the June 2016 meeting where the Russians were coming to share dirt on Hillary. And of course, already we know that there were something like, according to one count, 82 known contacts between the Trump team and Russia-linked operatives. None of these reported to authorities. So lots of suggestion of collusion and obstruction as plain as the president's tweets. And all of this perhaps coming to a head in the fall.
Catherine Rampell, Michael Cohen claims Donald Trump, as Jack said, there knew in advance about that 2016 Trump Tower meeting between Trump campaign officials and a Russian lawyer. President's attorney Rudy Giuliani called Cohen a pathological liar in response. Michael Cohen released an audio tape this week, and I want to play that now, of Donald Trump talking with his attorney, Michael Cohen, in 2016 about a plan to purchase the rights to model Karen McDougal's story of an alleged affair with Trump from the parent company of the National Enquirer. The first voice you'll hear here is Donald Trump. And the Allen that Michael Cohen refers to is Allen Weisselberg, the longtime chief financial officer of the Trump Organization. Here it is.
So what are we going to pay? Funding? That, yes. And it's all the stuff. All the stuff. Because, you know, you never know where that company, you never know where he's going to be. Correct. So I'm all over that. And I spoke to Allen about it when it comes time for the financing, which will be...
Listen, what financing?
We'll have to...
Catherine Rampell, what did you hear in those recordings?
I heard a refutation, if you will, of a lot of things that Trump and his people who surround him, either in the White House or on the campaign trail, a lot of things that they said, a lot of their denials are wrong. Surprise, surprise. That he actually did know about the various attempts to cover up accusations of sexual misconduct. But again, this is not terribly surprising. I'm not sure if there are many people out there who believed Trump was completely in the dark about these kinds of attempts to cover up bad news right before
the
election.
And yet, I'm not sure there's a bombshell here. I mean, it seems that you hear what you want to hear based on your feelings about this president. It seems both sides are spinning this to their advantage.
Well, yes, of course they are. I mean, we're in a very polarized climate, so people are going to color whatever news that comes out in whatever shade they want it to be. The issue here is, again, this casts doubt on the veracity of anything that Trump or his representatives say with regard to his finances, with regard to his past sexual misconduct. But do his supporters care? Probably not. They don't seem to have cared. This does raise a lot of questions, of course, about potential campaign finance violations, about potential tax fraud. You know, there are a lot of complicated issues surrounding, was this a deducted expense, deducted business expense for Trump to have funded these kinds of cover-ups, if it was, in fact, basically a political campaign donation. So there are a lot of issues raised by all of this. I don't know that it'll really change how anybody feels about Trump, whether you like him or hate him.
So, Weijia Jiang, what's the mood at the White House about this tape and really the bigger question about what other tapes there are out there?
You know, I think the White House learned its lesson when it chimed in, specifically when Press Secretary Sarah Sanders chimed in about the Stormy Daniels payment. She stood at the podium. She declared that the president did not know about that payment. And then, as we saw, it was a very tense briefing when she had to answer to many questions after the president himself tweeted a series of tweets that indicated and confirmed that actually he did know about it. And so officially from the White House, the answer that we get over and over and over when we try to ask questions about this is you'll have to refer to the president's outside counsel, which is Rudy Giuliani. And as we saw, just as Catherine pointed out, yes, he is trying to spin this, even providing a transcript of what he says the president was saying in that tape. But it doesn't matter. You know, they seem to really go back and forth on whether the president was talking about cash or a check. But regardless of how he was going to pay, the fact is he clearly knew about a payment and was talking about how to fund that. And so the White House is, you know, putting this off and saying this is something that, you know, doesn't have to do with the official team here. But obviously they're concerned about it because it casts doubt on the president's credibility. And that's the bigger issue here. But I think the takeaway is when you look at the fact that Michael Cohen has now hired Lanny Davis, put him on television, put these tapes out there, the question then becomes how much further is Cohen willing to go as this investigation?
Well, I think that's the question, Jack Beatty. It's clear that the man who once said he would take a bullet for Donald Trump seems to be making a break from his longtime client.
Yes, and reporting is that he's been hurt by the president referring to him at one point as his lawyer in the past tense. And the president has attacked him, as has Rudy Giuliani. And even perhaps more risky for the president comes the news that Alan Weisselberg, who's the CFO of the Trump Organization, has been called to testify in the Cohen inquest. Mm. And he has been with that firm and family pretty much since the beginning. And he, as people put it, he knows where the financial bodies are buried. And any testimony from him risks crossing what the president called his red line. That would be the line where he would want to stop the inquest because it was dealing with his going into his business past.
Let's move on now to a big Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing on Wednesday. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo testified about what Russian President Vladimir Putin and President Trump discussed during their private meeting in Helsinki last week. Here is a terse exchange between Pompeo and New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez.
The president was very clear with Vladimir Putin about U.S. positions.
He told you that.
Senator, I understand the game that you're playing.
No,
I get
no,
it.
You know, Mr. Secretary, with all due respect, I don't appreciate you characterizing my questions. My questions is to get to the truth. We don't know what the truth is.
So, Catherine Rampell, Secretary of State Pompeo repeatedly declined to provide specifics about the one-on-one meeting between Trump and Putin in Helsinki. What did you hear in his testimony this week?
Well, he wasn't in that one-on-one meeting by definition,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
I wonder to what extent the people surrounding Trump, including in cabinet posts, actually know about the content of that discussion. There was probably a reason why they were excluded from that meeting. We don't know how much of the contents of that discussion were actually shared with those around him. And the very fact that he excluded these very senior officials from those discussions so that there is no one there, so that there was no one there to witness that conversation aside from the translator is troubling and suggests that there was something to hide. So I don't know why Pompeo was so testy. It may be that he didn't want to give up whatever information he had, and it may be that he didn't actually have that much information.
Well,
but I support Congress doing its job and trying to exercise some oversight over this White House. So Pompeo needs to answer these questions to the extent that he is able to.
Weijia Jiang, Pompeo spent a lot of time trying to convince those lawmakers on that panel that President Trump's policies matter toward Russia, not necessarily his words. What did you hear in all that? Some political theater or something, some truth there?
Well, we don't know exactly what his policies are. That's part of the problem. And so I think that that tone that you hear from the secretary mimics what we're hearing from the White House, which is one of defense, because for some reason they don't even want to take questions about what may or may not have unfolded during that meeting. Because another problem is that Russia is saying something different from what the White House is, right? They are saying that, you know, not only were agreements reached, but we are ready to implement them. Meanwhile, you know, the official word here is that the only agreement that was reached was another summit, was to have another mm-hmm. meeting and have mm-hmm. ongoing negotiations. But because we don't know what the president agreed to, there are still so many looming questions about his policy and how he plans to proceed, even though they used very broad language about, you know, working to achieve peace in Syria, mm-hmm. About, you know, a wide range of issues. But the problem is there's no specifics. And the other question that I'm trying to find out is, you know, when this information unfolds, is it coming from notes that the president took? Did he put a pen to paper in that meeting? Or is this solely based on his recollection of the conversation, which is a problem? Because I don't know about you, but, you know, if you ask me now to go over details of a conversation that I had weeks ago, the more time that passes and the more time that goes on without these details, the harder it is to remember them. And those details, every word in that 2-hour meeting is critical.
Jack Beatty, your thoughts?
Yes, and to pick up on that, Norwegian didn't. You haven't committed or spoken. What is it? 3,000 falsehoods. You probably have a pretty consistent record of truth telling. So that when you say, "Yeah, my recollection is flawed, but here's my best recollection," I don't think anyone could doubt that it is your best recollection. The president, on the other hand, simply has no credibility about claiming. I'm trying to be honest here. Here's what was said. Who could believe him after this river of lies?
We are discussing this week's biggest news stories with Jack Beatty, Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, and Weijia Jiang of CBS News. Listeners, we'd love to have you join us. Do you think those migrant families will ever be reunited, those children with their parents? If not, who do you blame? Were you heartened to see North Korea hand over the expected remains of U.S. soldiers? I'm Jane Clayson. Stick with us. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. In other news this week, deadly wildfires scorched parts of Greece, killing dozens of people. Many fled toward the coast to escape the inferno. Survivors spoke to the BBC.
Thankfully, the sea was there, and we went into the sea because the flames were chasing us all the way to the water. It burnt our backs, and we jumped into the water.
Facebook this week took a free fall, the single biggest one-day loss in stock market history. Here's NBC's Tom Costello.
The sell-off was staggering and unprecedented. Facebook losing $119 billion in market value today alone.
And Ivanka Trump closes shop on her clothing line. Jimmy Kimmel had a little fun with the announcement.
The good news is no American jobs will be lost because almost every piece of her clothing was made overseas. So,
listeners, you can join the conversation this hour. What's on your radar this week? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Weijia Jiang this hour of CBS News, Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, and On Point's Jack Beatty. I want to get this clip in here because there was a lot of talk of the White House reporter, CNN's Caitlin Collins, who was barred from an open press event in the Rose Garden yesterday after asking President Trump what his communication staff called, quote, inappropriate questions earlier in the day. Here is what Collins told CNN's Wolf Blitzer on Wednesday night.
And I was simply just doing my job, asking questions of the president about the news of the day, some of the things the president had already remarked on and then would make news on later when he did issue that statement through the National Security Advisor, John Bolton. But clearly the White House was not pleased with those questions we had for the president today.
Weijia Jiang, talk me through what happened there and the response from the White House press corps.
You know, I think it's important to make the distinction of Caitlin's role that day. She wasn't just working for CNN. She was the TV network pool reporter. And that means she was representing all of the TV networks because not all of us could go into this event in the Oval Office. And so she was asking the questions that all of us wanted to ask. And this is not new. This happens every time there is an event with the president after he makes remarks, reporters ask questions. And frankly, you know, our Stephen Portnoy of radio, CBS News Radio, was also in that room. And he says, look, she wasn't being louder than anybody else. She wasn't, refusing to leave more than anybody else.
She was asking questions.
Right. She was asking questions. She was doing her job. And so you have to wonder, is it the content of the questions that irked the White House? Because she was asking about Michael Cohen. She was asking why Vladimir Putin had not yet accepted the president's invitation to the White House. The White House says it was her behavior. It was not the content, but it was because she refused to leave. And when the president says thank you, he means the event is over, which is not true. When the president says thank you in the past, that's
kind of a jumping off point that says, okay, I'm done with what I'm here to say. Do you have any questions? It depends on what mood President Trump is. And not only is it typical for reporters to ask questions off topic, it is typical for the president to answer. And if he is in the mood, he will talk sometimes for 15, 20, 25 minutes and take questions. So there are a lot of factors at play here. I think it's extraordinary, though, that she was asked to sit out of the next event. And the White House press corps responded swiftly and stood around her and said, you know, this is unacceptable because it sets a dangerous precedent and we will not be controlled. And you cannot dictate what you believe is an appropriate question or not. That's not up to you or up to us. You know, Americans can decide whether they believe a question is inappropriate or not based on how they consume the news. And that's a different conversation. But the point is, I think everybody, you know, in that press corps really felt this as a personal attack and made it clear that, you know, when someone is doing their job, that's all it is. It's just doing the job.
Fox News anchors and reporters even defended that CNN reporter and what happened that day. Earlier in the week, during remarks to the Veterans of Foreign Wars National Convention in Kansas City, President Trump lambasted the media, telling the audience, don't believe the, quote, crap you see from these people, the fake news, end quote.
Just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
What you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening. Jack Beatty, your thoughts about that?
Well, of course, everybody has gone to Orwell's 1984 to dig up quotations like this one. Quote, the party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command. I think we all have to look at what he said there. You know, don't believe what you're seeing. Don't believe reality, believe me. There's a phrase of Lionel Trilling's, the moral obligation to be intelligent. We have a moral obligation, a civic obligation to be intelligent, to try to read the world as it is. Certainly not as a self-interested leader tells us. And this is a test of citizenship for people. Do they really want themselves to be described as people who don't believe the evidence of their senses and believe a supreme leader? And does that idea of citizenship comport with any model of democratic life that we know of? It's a scandal that the president could say something like that. It's an even bigger scandal that so many people believe him.
Let me get a caller in here at this point. Jim is in Newtown, Connecticut. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I just wanted to speak to the child reunification issue.
Okay.
One of the most disgraceful, appalling chapters I've ever seen. I never thought I'd see this day. The traumatization of these children, no planning, no mental health counselors when they've been through the trauma. And the criminality of this is just astounding. The fact that people, the fact is there's a long way to go to still reunify the kids that are left, over 700. And then there are children, teenagers in facilities where we're hearing about forced drugging and bags over their heads. This, we have a long way to go. And here in Newtown, we launched a white ribbon campaign. And I would just invite your listeners to check out the song and on YouTube, tie a white ribbon. And
Jim, thank you. No, I do appreciate you bringing up this issue because the deadline this week passed to reunite migrant children with their parents, Jim. And so this is important. Generally, but timely this week, Catherine Rampell, did the U.S. meet that deadline?
No. Astonishingly, no. And it just reflects how little planning went into this inhumane and cruel policy that was effectively state-sanctioned and enforced child abuse. There are hundreds of children who are still not with their parents in violation of a federal court order. My question is, why is no one being held in contempt of court for violating that federal court order? And I think the answer is because they're too disorganized. There was no planning that went into this mass separation of families, including toddlers and other very young children, that would even have allowed them to comply with this court order. You know, it just shows how thoughtlessly they enacted a really inhumane policy. But yes, there are still hundreds of children who are apart from their parents.
700, as I'm reading here. Weijia Jiang, what does the White House say is the plan to get these kids back with their parents, many of whom have been deported? They've left the country.
And that's the problem, is that they really don't have a plan yet. And it's been so frustrating covering this because it was messy from the very beginning. Health and Human Services immediately almost released a statement through their administration for children and families that said, you know, these children who are separated as a result of this policy would be put into the unaccompanied children program, just like any other unaccompanied child, whether it was a result of this policy or not. And then the very next day, they had to retract that and say, that's not true. We're actually looking at these children differently. And, you know, we will give you details as we have them. That was quite a while ago. And to this point, today, that hasn't changed. And we don't have any specifics about how they are identifying these children separately from those who are already in their custody before this zero tolerance policy. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, a lot of their parents have been deported already. And so there is this dilemma of just not only reuniting, but even just, making sure that those channels are open to get to that next step. And so it has really been difficult to watch and uncover because the administration does not seem to have one message about what they're doing. And they, you know, they keep pointing to each other, to different agencies in terms of who has those answers.
Let me get Cameron in here on this point from Orford, New Hampshire. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
The big thing that, for me, you know, having grown up in a small town in New Hampshire and not really being near to all this stuff when I went to Central America in high school, it's really evident to see why some of these people don't have any other option than to come here illegally or through some other means because either they don't have the money or resources to make it here illegally or make it here legally, or they just can't afford to go through the legal process because it's so long and drawn out. So
yeah.
I hope that whatever is going on, something good will eventually come through. We can get all these kids back with their parents.
Many people want that same thing, Cameron. Thank you very much for calling. We'll keep watching this, of course. I want to talk about North Korea for a moment. Earlier this week, President Trump tweeted that a rocket has not been launched by North Korea in 9 months, and likewise, no nuclear tests. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo acknowledged on Wednesday that North Korea continues to produce nuclear fuel for its weapons program. Weijia Jiang, I presume the White House is somewhat frustrated that this isn't moving quickly and more in their direction. How have they responded to all of this?
Well, certainly they would never say that. Mm-hmm. And they continued to say that progress is being made. Secretary Pompeo was grilled on the Hill as well about any evidence, any concrete proof that North Korea is taking steps. And you're right. They continue to point out, these test missiles and that Kim Jong-un has destroyed testing sites. But the question remains, what about the existing arsenal of weapons? And what steps is he taking, or has he at least committed to taking, to gather and dismantle those weapons? And we still don't have an answer. And so I think we are seeing the administration push back a bit and not take as many victory laps as we were seeing before, because the fact is they don't have that piece. And so that means that not much progress at all has been made since these two leaders agreed to have a summit. And, you know, there are calls now for the administration to resume the joint military exercises with South Korea because those were only suspended based on the idea that North Korea would continue to negotiate in good faith. But we've seen sort of an up and down in that negotiation, and we've seen tough language again from North Korea. And so, you know, to answer your question, the administration does not have those answers to provide when it comes to exactly what North Korea
is doing to get to the end goal.
Talking about tough language, it feels like a lifetime ago, but President Trump's all-caps warning to Iran late Sunday night to the Iranian president, never, ever threaten the United States again or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout the history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious. Catherine Rampell, the entire world tuned its attention to that on Monday, but it seemed like it flamed out as quickly as it flared up.
Which is often the story with inflammatory Trump tweets. And I hope that this doesn't reignite, to continue the metaphor. But look, that seemed like very reckless language, which is something we should come to expect, I guess, from this White House when it comes to any sort of foreign relations. The president tweets very threatening words to both friends and foes alike. This was startling when he tweeted it, whenever that was, Sunday night. I think it's good news that he seems to have gotten distracted by other things or moved on or what have you. And let's hope that he doesn't get interested in this subject again, particularly with National Security Advisor John Bolton, who is very hawkish, whispering in his ear.
Jack Beatty, it sounded like that that fire and fury comment that the president made about North Korea a year ago. How did you view it?
Yes, I saw it that way, too. And the president, I think, the next day sort of couched it that way and said, well, maybe we'll have talks with Iran and it'll work out. But, you know, this is a very... As we enter the end game, or at least part of it, of the Mueller investigation, the president is going to be under tremendous temptation to foment a foreign crisis. And here's one just waiting for him. He said that rhetoric, he seems to be saying here, rhetoric is enough to trigger this unprecedented apocalyptic U.S. response. Rhetoric is going to get us to go to war? It's a very dangerous moment. And he may be tempted to heat up tensions there, and you know they can respond, and things can get out of hand, and soon we can be involved in another war in the Middle East.
About a half a minute here before we have to go. Weijia Jiang, Catherine Rampell, what are you keeping an eye on ahead of next week? Weijia Jiang.
Well, I think the Cohen tapes will continue to be in the headlines because we have yet to hear from the president himself, unless it's on Twitter. And this is really important because we've seen recently that he has made a distinction between collusion and meddling, even though he continues to say there was no collusion. Unlike in the past, it seems that he is acknowledging the difference. And I don't imagine that this is going to stop. And we're anticipating even more trickling out from Michael Cohen.
Catherine Rampell, top of mind for you looking ahead?
Also the Cohen tapes, also what's going on the trade front, whether there's actually any progress or whether Trump changes his mind again and decides to lob some insults at our friends and trading partners.
Well, a great wrap-up with a great panel. Catherine Rampell, columnist for The Washington Post. Catherine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Weijia Jiang, White House correspondent for CBS News. Weijia, thank you.
Thank you.
On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. As always, Jack, have a good weekend.
Thank you, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast. Our website's at onpointradio.org. We're on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Have a great weekend. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Thank you.